You're listening to the Evolvement Podcast with your boy, Nye, where cryptocurrency, Bitcoin, and our financial future are the hot topics.
That is the future.
Thank you for tuning in. And now, get ready. We are going live in 3, 2, 1.
What is going on, everybody? What is going on? It is your boy, Nye, and welcome to another episode of Evolvement, the financial podcast where we talk about Bitcoin, cryptocurrency, and the future of our financial systems.
I want to give a big thank you to Nexo for sponsoring our security token series. Nexo is a blockchain-based overdraft system that allows users to make instant crypto loans. At this moment, there's no other way in which crypto owners can use their assets other than selling and buying them. Nexo comes forth with a very lucrative business model where it allows crypto owners to use their holdings as collateral, then withdraw cash. The user maintains 100% access to their cryptocurrency while they have immediate access to cash as well. Check out Nexo at nexo.io. Thank you to our final sponsors, Zenledger. Zenledger is the simplest solution to organizing your capital gains or losses this tax season. They offer a plug-and-play option that makes it easier than ever to complete your crypto taxes in record time. Learn more at zenledger.io.
Today, I'm here with a very special guest, Steven. Welcome, Steven. How are you doing, my man?
Hey, going great to be here.
Yeah, glad to have you on, dude. So today we're going to sit down, we're going to talk a little bit about ICOs, STOs, and really the legality behind them. So this is kind of, this is an episode, the goal with this series is, it's called the Security Token Series. The goal is I wanted to get 5 or 6 different experts who know heavily about security tokens and different aspects, different perspectives around security tokens to bring different educational content to people. You know, I think that there's a lot of hype being built around security tokens right now. People are like talking about them a lot, but I think there's a lot of confusion about who's going to be involved with this industry, who's going to be able to trade these coins, how these coins are structured from a legal standpoint, and you being like the legal expert that I've ever met or ever heard of behind ICOs and the mastermind behind structuring the legality of the Ethereum ICO and a bunch of other things. I wanted to bring you on, so thanks for coming.
Yeah, I'm really excited about it. I love your podcast. I'm a huge fan. I'm really excited about what security tokens can bring cool. to the world.
Sweet. So before we get into talking about security tokens, can you just give the audience and even myself, like who are you? Like, what's your background? What were you doing before crypto? And what inspired you to step into the space?
Guys, sometimes I don't remember that there was a life before crypto. I mean, this rabbit hole is deep. I was a tech entrepreneur both in Silicon Valley and New York for 20 plus years. Started a whole bunch of different tech companies, mostly in the internet area. And then I'm also an attorney by training and a venture capitalist as well. So kind of did all three of those. Then was primarily working in artificial intelligence when somebody explained what Bitcoin was to me. And then I read the white paper and a eureka moment kind of went off in my head. And I look at it kind of like the Bitcoin to me is like those ink spot tests that psychologists use. And it's like, Bitcoin, everybody looks at Bitcoin and sees something different in it. You know, so some people it's like, you know, money, some people it's like freedom. It's, you know, it's everybody, and that's kind of one of the like amazing beauties of this great invention. And so I came, you know, like a lot of people in this space, I came from a fairly libertarian background and spent a lot of years like in the gold market and thinking about, you know, it was going to be hyperinflation and war and this horrible thing. And then we would reset the whole economy and a new monetary system. And then when I saw Bitcoin, I was floored because I was like, oh my God, this is, to me, it looked like the new monetary system. And even though I went in tech, the last thing I didn't even think about that it was going to be a technology invention that could usher in a new monetary system. So to me, it was super exciting when I first saw it.
I like it. Do you still think it's going to be the new monetary system? Is that still your hope with Bitcoin?
I'm more convinced today than I've ever been. Cool. Yeah, absolutely. So I wouldn't, you know, there's, I believe, yeah, I kind of, there's a little part of me that's a Bitcoin maximalist as far as monetary goes. But then the rest of me is not in terms of, I believe that the underlying technology that Satoshi gave us just in terms of blockchain has spawned multiple revolutions. And I like to say they just have like ancestral roots. And Bitcoin itself is one of those.
Perfect. I love that. And your like official title with like the working with Ethereum, or at least at the very beginning, was you were like a legal architect.
Right. So my role there was to figure out a way for us to do a crowd sale. And then we had very ambitious plans for a crowd sale, but for it not to be deemed to be a security. And frankly, that just had never happened before. You know, there was a few crowd sales in crypto. There were like three before that, and they just hadn't given any thought to, you know, what they were doing and how they were doing it. So fortunately, you had a really thoughtful group of guys there. Frankly, it was, you know, in hindsight, when I look back, I'm just in awe of like the brain power, you know, that was in that group of guys. And in particular, Vitalik gave me the room and kind of explained, you know, backed off everybody and said, we need to figure this out and do this properly. Problem was, there wasn't any sort of legal construct ever created to figure out how to issue a token in a crowd sale that would not be deemed to be a security. So what happened was the story basically, I mean, the backstory to how it happened was pretty interesting. It was having drinks with Vitalik one night, and we were still so early on, and this was in early 2014, we were still kind of getting our hands around the concept of gas and what that means and how it operates within the protocol, and that you need it kind of to send it, so to speak, and that it feeds the dApps and smart contracts. And so it dawned on me, this is one of those just, you know, eureka moments that I didn't think was going to amount to much. And I asked him, I said, I said, you need this stuff to send this stuff, right? And I was talking about Ether, and he said, yeah, why? And I said, well, it's kind of like a good. You know, I mean, it's kind of like actual real gas. You need to put in a card to get the car to go to a different location. And he said, that's right. And I said, well, by definition, everybody who purchases Ether in the sale will eventually be a user of the system, even if they're really just, you know, using some Ether to send their Ether to somebody else. So it was an interesting use case, frankly, that you had that where everybody had to be a user of the system. And so the idea that I had, I said, well, what if we just say we're actually, this is the future sale of a good. And it's effectively like a piece of code. And I said, we're going to be selling this future piece of code to people to use it in the system. And kind of a rough analogy that we were using back at that time was like, imagine you, there was a new subway that was being developed. And I said, well, if we're building this new subway and we're selling people tokens for the subway, and we're saying that once the subway is built, you'll get your tokens to ride the subway. And even if you want to sell your tokens and you want to do nothing else, you have to at least take one ride on the subway for one stop and use one token in order to do that. So by definition, everybody buying it will be a user of the system. Though we anticipate it to be fair when we actually went forward with this was that we were very, very, very clear. We were not selling this as an investment. We told people, do not buy this if you're looking to buy this as an investment. We told people that this is a good you're buying, and the purpose, if you're buying it, you should only be buying it if you intend to actually use it. So, you know, there's many different ways you could be using. You could be building a dApp, you could be saving yourself for that, you could be smart contracts, there's all kinds of things. But it wasn't for price appreciation. Now, doesn't mean that price appreciation can't happen, but the basis of like when you look at things like the Howey test, and it's four different prongs there, but one of those is profit motive. And we wanted to be really clear with people that that should not be their motive. We went out of our way to tell them that. Fortunately, I was working with a former chairman of the SEC, and I kind of frankly sheepishly went to him with this idea that we're not raising money and that we're going to him as sale of a good. And I say sheepish not because I didn't believe it. I actually thought that it made sense. It was logical what we were doing. This was a new thing that had never happened before. When I explained it to him, and you know, it was outside of anything that had like been happened before, he actually came back very shockingly to me and said he thought it was like a brilliant idea. And then, you know, we had a firm that we were working with, and we presented the idea to them that this is the legal contract. This is how we want to conduct the sale of these goods. You know, there were some aspects to work out. Like, you were buying it now, but the mainnet had not gone live. Mm-hmm. Right? So how did you handle that? And in that case, what we did was we said, all right, the ether will be there, but you can't access it until we go live with mainnet. What was really shocking was that was like, I think, 9 or 10 months later, they actually built Ethereum.
So you guys were pretty much building out the structure of what the future or what the current ICO, like legality model looks like through this whole process too. It wasn't even, you didn't come in, you're like, oh, well, this is the clear regulation of what needs to be done, what doesn't need to be done. You pretty much helped set it up and create that structure, am I right?
Right, so none of this existed.
Yeah.
Right? So there was no legal construct to implement. The idea that I'd come up and ran by them to have this as a sale of a future good. I mean, future good because we're delivering it later, or you'll have access to this good, the ether later. In hindsight, revolutionary. I didn't anticipate it, frankly, at the time. And if it was up to me, I told people, let's not tell anybody that we're doing this.
Yeah.
Not because I didn't think there was anything wrong, but it was just like, you know, this was our, you know, private legal matter. And we did explain to people what we were doing. Of course, things don't always happen that way. And what happened was word got out in terms of what we were doing. And it wasn't that difficult if you were... understood the current regime of securities, and you took a look at our terms of service and our other legal documents that were available publicly, then you could fairly well tell what it was that we were doing differently than, you know, other folks had done before. That effectively, with one other main development, then that's the ERC-20 standard. So if you take the ERC-20 standard and then the legal construct that I came up with for the sale, you marry those two, that effectively gave rise to the boom in ICOs that happened a couple of years later.
And what's the C-20 standard?
The ERC-20.
ERC-20.
Oh, sorry, the ERC-20. Yeah. So the ERC-20 standard was super important because now we had, you know, with what I did was you had a legal construct to say, okay, if you go down this route, and it's really important because you have to actually really do what we said we were doing. We were super strict about the way we went about it. And it was not a securities offering and didn't look like a securities offering. And in reality, it wasn't in substance. And then you marry that with the standard token model. And so the ERC-20 was really a brilliant stroke that came out of the Ethereum Foundation. Those two gave rise to this boom in, I'll say in utility tokens, but then in the ICO fundraising model. That all being said, I was a huge vocal voice while it was happening because I saw what was happening and I saw folks that were not actually doing what we said they were doing, but they were actually doing real securities offerings. And they were just, it was a wolf in sheep's clothes, so to speak. And you know, there were abuses, fraud, but I think the fraud actually in this market wasn't as big as more the abuses, where they were really doing securities offerings and they were saying that it was, you know, our legal construct when most of the times, more often than not, was not.
Interesting. And when you were first setting this up, what was like the biggest struggle for you guys? Was working, like you said, I think you mentioned you were talking with the SEC. Was that like challenging to do, to work with them to figure out the struggle? Or what was like the biggest a barrier that you overcame?
So we wouldn't actually work directly with the SEC. What we had access to was a guy who used to be the chairman of the SEC previously. But what we had, really the biggest challenge was what you have anytime there's an invention, right? It was like getting people comfortable with here is a completely new instrument, this like programmable code thing that people use as in ways that they just had never used it before because tokens had never existed. And what the issue really was is that the legal securities regime, particularly the 33 and 34 Act in the U.S. and the regulations under there, it was a round peg square hole situation. Right? They just did not apply. They're almost 100 years old, and nobody obviously anticipated this, and they're outdated laws. And so I guess the biggest issue would be getting people comfortable with here changing this, you know, and if we conduct a sale in a certain manner, and we have this new instrument that just never existed before with characteristics that no instrument had before this, you had to get people through the logic and say, logically, here's what we have. Logically, here's the current legal precedents. And how do we, you know, weave through that in a really fair, conservative manner? But the good thing there was that the logic actually, even today, I believe it's fairly solid in hindsight. And if you really follow it diligently, and it's not really a securities offering and draped into this, then it should work.
I like it. And we're moving into STOs, right?
Yeah, so that's actually what gave me the impetus for STOs. So it was around 2017, and I was getting super uncomfortable with what was going on out there. And to be clear, like we...
Super uncomfortable with like the ICOs that were popping up, and they were handling like regulations and things like that.
Yeah, so I mean, I was looking at a lot of these ICOs and saying, wait, no, these, you know, one after another... I was looking like a securities offering to me. And I said, this is not what we intended. This was not the point of this, right? And it looked like people were trying to effectively sell equity or equity-like stuff. People were looking for price appreciation. Again, price appreciation happening is not really it's the intent going into it. And so it seemed like it was very much of that, you know, mix. And so I fortunately got involved in a couple of projects early on. I was working with the T-Zero guys, the Polymath guys. And so this was like in the earlier part of 2017. And I said, yeah, okay, so that is the answer. And so to me, the security token concept seemed so elegant for a couple of reasons. One, it really differentiated. So if you still have a token and you want to sell this token, that's okay. You have to... you know, work within legal regulations. And in particular, it's important for folks on the international scene, meaning non-US in this respect. This is mostly a US phenomenon, but that's important today because the US is either, the standard where the rest of the world goes, or if it's not, it will definitely be an impediment to the rest of the world's advancement. And that's more often than not, it's the latter. What I saw here is I said, okay, here's a clear way. If you don't fall under a utility token, having something that you're purchasing to participate in a network, so to speak, but you really want to do something that's more investor-like, here's your other option. You can go under this realm. And that opened up quickly, it started dawning on me that opened up a massive, gargantuan market. And like when I say gargantuan, there's some estimates it runs into the multiple quadrillions of dollars, which is like, the first time I said that word, I had to look it up because it was like, I'm like, is that 1,000 trillion? Like that, it is. Yeah. And so it's a big number.
It's a big number. It's a real big number. And to like for a super basic definition, what's the difference between an STO and normal equity? Like, why would someone utilize the security token standard versus going just a normal equity route or going a normal IPO route?
So, at a super high level, one way to think about a security token is it's kind of just the form of the issuance. It's not the underlying legal construct. What I mean by that is, you can have a stock certificate, a physical, you know, everybody's probably seen these physical stock certificate. But underlying that, that may mean you own equity in a company, mm-hmm. right? So that's different. So the equity is like the legal definition of what it is and of what you own. And then the physical form happens to be a piece of paper in that respect or a digit on your screen.
Okay.
And so what security tokens offered were, this was like the key differentiator. It was the jump from digital to programmable or cryptographic. And that made a big difference. So you were previously, you had just digits on a screen, basically. Now you have this piece of programmable code, which that in and of itself is just what holds whatever rights you have. Right, so the security token is just holding the rights. Now, when you ask about equity, the rights that you have could be equity rights, as a, like a traditional shareholder. They could be a revenue share. They could be a profit participation. Many, many, many different ways that you can skin the cat. And in particular with security tokens, it gets super interesting and complicated because it can actually change because it's programmable. And mm-hmm. we've never had that before. And that is a game changer. Like you didn't before say, well, it could be equity and sometimes, and if you do something as an equity holder, you have the rights to do, you know, maybe certain, you know, additional participation. And, you know, it's like really interesting. It changes the whole structure of investing. It changes the idea of how companies interact with their shareholders. So the implications are pretty far-reaching.
That's super interesting. So like the security token itself can house multiple different benefits based upon what the company that's setting up the security token decides to offer.
Correct. And they're not all, by the way, the where it gets really interesting is they're not always security-like features either. So you can take features that a lot of us have associated with utility tokens, let's say a discount on services, right, on purchases of goods from this company that's issuing the security token. And the security token may say, okay, you have rights to like an equity holder, you have a shareholder, but at the same time, if you have 10,000 tokens, you also have the right to get 10% off of our products. Or maybe you have right to exclusive access. And, you know, I mean, like the marketing department can think all the ways that they want in terms of how they do that. But what now that kind of happens with that is, you know, one implication of that particular example, where I've seen a number on the drawing board that are looking at that, it's like your investor relations department and your marketing department start kind of colliding with each other. And where these used to be very different areas, and now companies can actually use raising capital, but they also can say, okay, like I want my suppliers to actually buy this and invest in me, so they're, you know, more invested in my success, and in return, you know, based on how much they purchase, they're going to get discounts, you know, when they're buying, you know, when we're doing business together. It's certainly confusing, and this is part of the reason. Well, the main issue comes down to why it gets so confusing, legal issues aside, is that it's programmable. And so we just never had that. It was, you know, you bought stock, you own stock, end of story. You know, you got a dividend, the entire class got a dividend. It didn't matter what you did differently than what somebody else in the same class of shareholders did. But tokens changes that.
Is it more complicated than the ICO legality? I mean, we have a structure for securities already built. So not necessarily having to build everything from scratch, but it seems like you might be having to build some things from scratch since it's digital and programmable. What's the difference there?
Yeah, so I would say it's like a wedding cake, right? And the securities laws is like, you know, the base layer of wedding cake, and now you're adding additional components to that wedding cake, and additional layers to it. And so like another layer to the wedding cake is what we think of as utility token features can be embedded into the security token. One way to think about it is if there's security token-like features and utility token-like features, it's probably a safe bet to assume the regulators think it's a security first. And it doesn't like the utility token. Like if you get a discount on services, that's going to whitewash the fact that you're also getting equity-like features out of this. Right? So it's the securities law will probably always trump it, but the two can now mix together. Okay. So, you know, some companies will issue both, you know, because they want to separate them, and some can issue them together.
And you see this as like massive in terms of the whole STO security token market. Do you think this is going to be something that plays a very large role in the way our financial and economic system is working and things like that? Or
I think when companies start realizing that they can, you know, raising money and they want their shareholders always to be advocates for the company, but they didn't really have the way of connecting the shareholders economically to the fortunes of the entity. Right? And now you're actually saying to people, all right, I'm going to embed these various benefits into otherwise what you would think of as the shares you're buying, but I'm going to embed it into the security token. And based upon things that you do or how many security tokens you own, you know, you'll get these various benefits. And it's, you know, it's not, it's very much actually in line with the trend that you're seeing where we're moving away because of the decentralized model. We're moving away from like the monolithic company just dealing with the customer one-on-one, where now they're moving away from the center of the circle to becoming also a participant with everybody else. And helping, you know, the network grow. And in line with that, also the way they're, you know, raise capital is, and the benefits they can get from that are advancing too. So the smart companies are going to jump on that and utilize that. But they're, to be fair also, in security tokens, that's one aspect of what's happening. It's like any, you know, new anything that would you'd be talking about in quadrillions of dollars is a little more granular than that. And there's a few other areas of things that are happening as well.
Like what?
So, everybody says decentralize everything for years. That was the big, you know, you saw it on T-shirts and everything. And then now there's a new one called tokenize everything. Right? And it's... There, a big chunk of that, you know, multiple quadrillions of dollars that people talk about is the tokenization of assets that currently are not in liquid form. You can, you know, an easy example to look at is like the physical brick and mortar real estate out there. Most of that stuff is like physical. And some estimates are like right now there's about $250 trillion worth of that in the world. Security tokens are really good, easy, like lends itself super well to taking a very highly illiquid asset and one that may be very specialized. So even sounds like real estate is not, but real estate is actually very local. Each building is different than the other building. You can even get it specific as a floor, but security tokens, you can issue, spin out a security token on a building, on a group of buildings, and people can invest in that specific building. And then it also affords liquidity to the people that own the buildings right now. So you're seeing that, there are people that are looking at that in basically every major illiquid asset class. So you can look at, for example, venture funds and private equity funds, which are highly illiquid assets for the limited partners in those. They invest, they typically have 7 to 10 years, they'll get outflows from time to time based upon exits that the fund may have, but they tend not to be in the early years and it may not be at any point. Well, security tokens also changes that game because you can, again, tokenize the fund itself. Now all of a sudden, instead of having limited partner interests, and it may still be called limited partner interests, but again, it's the shell of it is a security token. That's something that can then trade on a security token exchange. And that means they'll have liquidity. So somebody may say, all right, I'm investing in this fund. And it changes the nature of how you think about that because limited partners right now only are investing in that fund with a conservative estimate generally is I don't need this money for 7 to 10 years. And I may never get any of it back. But when you have a security token offering, the fund is probably going to start using its funds over 5, 6, 7, 8 years. And it will have a different value throughout that period. But you can't ever trade on that previously. Now, we're not in a very way that was good generically worldwide, where just like any fund could use this technology to give liquidity to its limited partners. Security tokens now allow that. And so you may be an investor. You may not have been an investor in that fund because you didn't have a 7 to 10 year time horizon, but maybe you had a 2 year time horizon. So I want to get into this fund for the next 2 years. And maybe I don't want to sell all of it after 2 years, but every year thereafter, I want to take a certain percentage off the table. And you can't do that currently. With a security token, if your limited partner interest is wrapped in a security token, you could say, all right, after 2 years, I want to take X percent off the table, and you just go into the market and you sell it.
So more liquidity and more flexibility, pretty much.
Right. And that opens up the doors to, you know, it's in many levels when you tokenize things that are totally illiquid right now and you're allowing for more flexibility, it changes the nature of the whole game, you know, and it changes the mindset both of investors in the limited in the funds, but it also changes the funds themselves. Venture funds and hedge funds, for example, start to like blend into each other. You know, so hedge funds are doing trading and venture funds are generally long-term investors. But with security tokens, you know, they end up doing a lot of the same stuff because, you know, the venture funds are going to need the skill sets of how trading is happening. And the hedge funds are going to start being able to, they're used to having more liquidity, and now they can get into the venture game because there's more of a liquid asset for them to deal with.
Interesting. Really interesting. And for the normal investor, how does this process work, right? So for ICOs, sadly, for happily or sadly, depending upon your perspective, for a period of time, you could go in, no KYC, no AML, you could buy a token, you could sell it the next week for 5X. That's what made them so attractive during the 2017 kind of like hype phase. What does it look like for STOs? Like, what are the legalities in terms of what are people going to have to share, the extent of information they're going to have to share before they're able to purchase STOs? Is everyone going to be able to get in on this, or is this more of institutional investors, or what? How do you view that, and what's the process like?
So part of that depends upon the jurisdiction that you're in. Right now, and it also depends on the kind of offering. So there's no one answer. The typical private placement in the U.S. Is oftentimes done under something what's called Reg D, and then for foreign investors in the U.S. offering Reg S. And in those situations, generally you'll have to be an accredited investor. After a period of time, oftentimes it's a year afterwards, then unaccredited investors can participate. An example of this right now is actually literally a security token exchange that did a security token offering and that I was involved with called T0. Yeah. And so T0 raised a whole bunch of money to build out the security token offering that Patrick Byrne had been, you know, really he was ahead of everybody pretty much in this space. And that right now is trading on the security token exchange itself. But in August, it'll be 1 year since the offering closed. And there, it'll be a really interesting event because that's when unaccredited investors, which is an asset and income test, are allowed to participate in the U.S. And the anticipation will be like volumes should soar, liquidity should increase. Of course, it's very early in the process right now. In general, in terms of security tokens, there haven't been a lot of issuances yet. So that's the basic. But there are other areas where unaccredited can participate in the U.S. But abroad, they will have different standards. So each country can have its own standards. The only issue is that they're still trying to figure this out right now is how do they have different standards than, let's say, the U.S. standards when there's such a international component to these. You know, one of the benefits that security tokens offer, and really the lesson of the ICO boom was that capital with security crypto, right? We know crypto, like everybody talks about, I can send, you know, Bitcoin in, you know, 20 seconds, a minute, 2 minutes, whatever it is, to a cross-border, very, very low transaction fees, relatively speaking, to somebody in Africa. And what we're really saying is that, you know, crypto is like water. You know, it just wants to freely flow. It doesn't have the barriers of borders and regulations. And the ICO boom showed that capital in the form of crypto will flow exactly where it wants to go. And so people can say, you know, the abuses and all that. But the point, you know, the really underlying point of that was that, you know, these people decided that the capital wants to go to this project and it just flew right to that project. And that, I think, is just a very, very, very tiny, because maybe there was a few dozen millions of people around the world. It's actually a very small percentage number of people in the world that actually participated in these ICOs. But what it showed as an example is broader. You know, when I believe all securities are eventually going to become tokens, be it stock, be it bonds, be it, you know, equity, debt, well, everything, and illiquid assets. I believe almost all of that is going to eventually go into the form of a security token. So like everything on NASDAQ or New York Stock Exchange. And so what it's showing is like the ability for capital to flow globally into something using crypto, and security tokens are still crypto, is like tremendous. And imagine suddenly we're talking about this tiny market of blockchain projects. You have the entire world of assets, you know, that we know, or even assets that we're not even counting today. You know, some people are looking at, like, for example, intellectual property. Not much you can do with intellectual property right now, but there are some really interesting efforts to turn like a ridiculous amount of valuable intellectual property, like patents and things like that, licenses, and turn that into security tokens where people can invest in those assets, where they're just sitting dormant on a company's balance sheet. Company may have billions of dollars worth of IP, patents on the balance sheet. And unless they get into really complicated one-on-one negotiated, you know, licensing of that, it's very hard to get investors into the, specifically into the patents, you know, put that off as a separate asset of the company. Well, now they can monetize that asset. And what can you do with that? You know, once capital frees up, then you can do a lot of amazing things with that.
That's really interesting. And that would allow investors to pick out a specific idea that's been patented and say, like, wow, that's genius, and invest into that based upon their interest. That's
cool. Yeah, so there's, you can look at companies that are doing multiple lines of businesses where, you know, let's say I, you know, look at this beverage company and I like their, you know, regular offering, but I don't like their diet offering. And I want to just, you know, I think that diet fad is, you know, decreasing and people are going to the regular sugar, you know, and you can now, before you didn't have a way to really, you know, get granular on that for investors, you can spin off a security token that specifically tracks the revenue from the diet line and revenue from the non-diet line. And so whichever investors want to invest in that. Now, that may not be, you know, the biggest example, but it's probably not an unrealistic one. But even looking at other things where you look at, say, a company that has multiple, big pharma that may have 10 blockbuster drugs, and then they may also have another 30 drugs in clinical trials. Well, now that becomes really interesting, because right now you're investing in Merck, Johnson & Johnson, Pfizer as a big monolithic company. And I may be really interested in this one, you know, Alzheimer's, you know, stage three, you know, trial drug that I happen to, because I have expertise in that area, but I have no way of really investing in that area. It's embedded into this like $100 billion company. Well, now they can specifically target the investors that are interested in each one. And that, A, would probably bring the value of the entire enterprise when you add them all up. The sum will be more greater than the part. But it's interesting where it's, you're getting, you know, the whole leverage buyout boom that happened, you know, years ago and has continued and continued and continued, where people have taken companies and broken them up and then taken other companies and combined them together. Well, you don't need to do that anymore necessarily. You know, all that financial engineering, now tokens can accomplish, you know, many of the things that they, not everything that they were trying to accomplish, but they can accomplish many of the things that they were trying to accomplish. Where you're saying, I want to break out and get investors just for this line or this line and this line and sell them off separately. You pretty much can sell them off separately and still keep them in one company if you want to.
How far away do you think we are from something like that?
So I think security tokens as a general construct of, let's put it as Wall Street 2.0. And I think that's basically nothing short of what we're talking about here. This is the next evolution of Wall Street. So like a lot of technologies, I think that it's, people have overly expected near-term results and vastly under-expected long-term results. So it's, you know, it's not a 2019 event where you're going to see a lot of liquidity, but, you know, it's 2020, 2021, certainly by 2022. So it's the next 2-3 years where you're going to see this really mature in the sense that right now we're still finishing putting the infrastructure in place. So there's, you know, issuance providers, there's custody providers, there's the exchanges themselves, and then all these guys agreeing on standards and connecting to each other. So there's a, you know, an ecosystem much the way, let's say, stock and bond markets around the world work today, where they're all connected, there's everybody understands how things work. And so the players are right now feverishly putting all of that into place. And there's a lot of capital, a lot of really smart people working on that. So people were expecting that to be like right now. So that takes a little while. However, when it happens, I believe that the expectations, you know, over a period of time, it's, you know, people are going to look at the chart and say, oh, it's going to go up and to the right, you know, to this number. And I think it's going to continue and continue and continue going further and further and further, because the creativity of people in particularly the financial sector, you're giving them this new tool. The financial sector is, you know, like them or don't like them, they're about as creative as any other sector, and maybe more so than almost every other sector in the economy. They almost live and breathe off their creativity, and you're giving them a tool like they've never had before in order to create new financial engineering. And, you know, I laugh because it's a little ironic. There's a lot of people that are saying, you know all the banks are going to die because of Bitcoin, and it's a little ironic because the very technology that was spawned by Bitcoin, the underlying blockchain technology and the crypto aspect of it that spawned security tokens, has the likelihood or potential to cause the financial sector to be many, many, many times what it is today. And the banks or financial institutions that recognize that and also take advantage of it. So that means they have to pivot their business lines. Like, they can't just continue doing business the same way. We are going into a more decentralized world. And so they have to understand that they have to be participants in this broader network. They can't just be, you know, proprietary of everything, you know, them, their customers, and that's it. But they still have very valuable services to offer. They could benefit them, you know, vastly. Other ones will not. Other ones will wither and die. And then there's a whole new crop that I think you're going to either see large tech companies taking a big bite out of this. You've seen this with Facebook and the Facebook coin. That, you know, if you put crypto and then into Facebook, you know, there is the potential, at least, that, you know, 3 billion people and hundreds of millions of businesses, that they could become the largest bank in the world, largest financial institution. So there's, you know, there's a lot of potential creativity that can be used here. I think that the end number, you know, over decades, you know, to be fair, this is not a short-term phenomenon. This is a long secular trend that's been ignited by this tech. Will go further than I think most people can imagine right now.
Interesting. I got a couple more questions for you here. Security tokens exchanges. What's something like that going to look like? Is it going to look like a Binance where you can go on and obviously you're going to probably have to submit KYC and AML and all those things, but is it going to look like a normal exchange that looks today where you're trading assets back and forth like that, or what form is it going to take?
Yeah. So in some ways it will mimic current exchanges. So when I say Binance or even NASDAQ, you know, where you have trading, you have market makers, especially on the NASDAQ platform, where there's, so a lot of that stuff doesn't necessarily change. What really changes is the nature of the instrument that you have and the things that can be done with that. So it's not just the world is no longer clear cut where you're a debt investor or an equity investor, right? You know, you can mix those two in a security token. You can say, I have a claim on the company from a debt. I'm going to get interest because of debt that they have issued. And part of my money goes to the debt and part of my money goes to as a shareholder. You know, it's like the worlds are now colliding. But that's cool because the companies can tailor these instruments exactly to what they want. The exchanges will be, you know, I think there's a few differences though. One of them is they're going to be global. So, you know, as this infrastructure is building out, you know, these exchanges are, you know, like T0 that I was talking about earlier, like they had a global mindset from day one. It wasn't like we're just going to be doing the US, you know. Oftentimes you're doing this with partners or you're building out other, you know, because you have regulations and other jurisdictions to think about. But the end goal here will be 24/7 global. So once we have regulations and standards in place, what's going to be different is that when you're selling. You may be selling in the U.S. to somebody in Korea. And it is more of a peer-to-peer decentral system. So some of the other things that are different is it's very hard right now oftentimes to untangle trades. There's no clear, you know, the immutability and the things that we know blockchain does really well are game changers in securities. There's, you know, a lot of people don't know that in 2008, the financial crisis actually got triggered because of the system froze. You know, people don't remember, a lot of people don't, that was either settlement. Settlement, when you have a peer-to-peer settlement issue, like a system like this, and in particular, where you don't have multiple days, you have maybe just seconds or minutes, between, you know, when a trade settles or instantaneous settlement, that removes the possibility of the system freezing or dramatically reduces that. And we've seen the implications of what can happen when that happens. So that's one of the three biggest systemic risks to the financial markets that this resolves. And that's a huge one. There's, a bunch of other things that will be different, but it's not so much that when you're looking at the screen, maybe it'll look, a little bit better. And but it's really what's kind of happening really inside the markets that's very different. And then your selection, when you're, I don't think you're going to see the word stock exchange or bond exchange, 10, 20 years from now. You know, it may just be securities exchange or it may be instrument exchange. I don't know what the word is, but because these instruments are going to be so mixed with each other, those clear lines won't be the same. And, there's a lot of things that the regulators are going to have to grapple with. So the bond market has certain regulations that it deals with. The stock market has its regulations. The commodity markets has their regulations. Derivatives either do or don't have regulations. By the way, that's a whole other aspect of this. Derivatives on the security tokens are super interesting. And so all of those have to kind of be rethought because they're now can, a company has the ability to just issue all of it in one instrument potentially. Mm-hmm. And so I don't envy the regulators in having to deal with this. I mean, what's been spawned by tokens is really, I think they're doing the best that they can. They're trying to stay ahead of protecting the investors, but while still keeping innovation going. And that's not an enviable position. So a lot of people come down on the SEC in the US and, they're tasked with not spawning innovation, they're tasked with protecting the investor, but they're showing a very strong inclination that they do want to continue innovation. And frankly, at the end of the day, security tokens are a really good thing for bodies like the SEC. When the SEC has things where it needs to untangle trades and find out if, let's say, for example, it was insider trading or illegal short selling. And right now there's very easy way, and I don't say easy, but I'm saying from a big institutional way of kind of covering your tracks, so to speak. Just like in a lot of other things in blockchain, it's just transparent. Like it's there, you can see it, it's on the blockchain, you can't change it. You did something that you shouldn't have done, it's immutable, it's there. There's nothing that you can do, you can't create other trades to cover up these trades or whatever. So a lot of those shenanigans go out of the way, and that makes the SEC's job really easy. And I think one of the reasons they've been accepting of security tokens exchanges is that they see that their job as a regulator becomes a lot easier with these. And then frankly, it becomes even more simpler for them because a lot of people will stop doing the things that they're not supposed to be doing just because they know they're not going to be able to get away with it. So it makes their job even easier in that respect.
What are you excited about right now in terms of the crypto space, even in terms of STOs or whatever projects maybe you're working on? Like what excites you the most?
Yeah, so I mean, I look at crypto in a couple of different ways. I look at, to me, Bitcoin is its own thing. It's its own, dominion. It's, it's a new monetary system. And I don't know that necessarily the dollar or whatever is going to go away, but it's certainly, I believe, it's going to sit amongst equals at least. Then, you look at this whole utility token and the revolution that Ethereum spawned. And I look at that more as like an operating system type. And then you have blockchain technology underlying that's disrupting all kinds of industries. To me, they're all exciting. In particular, I've got very involved in an effort that I looked at kind of like the layer one stuff. You know, we're moving to layer two solutions. We're moving to more advanced app solutions, applications, and we haven't fixed layer one yet. And you know, Bitcoin has spoken for itself in terms of how it wants to move forward on its layer one, layer two solutions. That may actually be okay for a monetary system. I get the arguments there where you don't want to touch layer one, and maybe layer two solutions are okay. But when you have a much more complex system, like a smart contract system that's a worldwide virtual computer, it's a lot more complex. And the things that the interaction that the stakeholders are having is a lot more intense and a lot more taxing on the system. And the layer one solutions just, you know, are not sufficient currently. I don't believe any of the solutions out there. I think they're valuable use case ones, you know, super valuable, maybe like ridiculous, maybe more valuable than anything on the planet right now. But they're just not, you know, like when you're talking about a general main chain thing. And then I was, so in our efforts, I was the Casper Labs project is what came by that I got involved with. And I'm chairman of the parent company, which is Adaptive Holdings. And to me, they're really exciting. That was the a technology, but really an invention by Vlad Zamfir. And Vlad invented something, in my opinion, is on par with like Satoshi or what Vitalik did. And that's, you know, I think those are two of the greatest inventions in human history. And his was, how do we then scale this? And so they come, you know, I look at him like he's standing on their shoulders, you know, and so it's certainly, you needed all three of those. But he figured out a way to actually scale layer one in the Casper protocols. And so we're going to be releasing that relatively near term. And we're super excited about it because it's, you still need, and the financial system is an example, right? So you have Visa. Everybody wants to get to Visa-like levels in blockchain. They always talk about, well, we're doing Visa-like. Okay, but how are you doing it? And what I'm seeing out there is that virtually all the protocols are doing that in a way that has some centralized feature to it. You know, some may be significant centralized, and some may be, you know, like really low, like, you know, they may use randomization or other kinds of things that, you know, are trying to minimize the centralized component. But at the end of the day, there's always some central point of failure. There's always some central point of possible collusion. And I believe the reason Bitcoin and Ethereum are the two most widely accepted protocols and networks out there, most widely understood, they're the biggest brands. You know, it wasn't because they were the first, right? It was also because they're fully decentralized. Both of them are fully decentralized. And so I have a hard time understanding that, you know, like a main chain that's going to be like Internet 3.0, literally, and you're going to stick, you know, hundreds and possibly thousands of trillions of dollars of value on these chains. And, you know, even if there's a 0.0001% chance of collusion or other happenings because of a central point of failure or central point of misconduct, is hard to accept. I do think that there's very valuable use cases, and we're seeing some of the chains that are getting really good adoption. And I think that there's room for many, many, many chains. But for the big ones that are going to handle like monetary system, like Bitcoin, or is going to be the main smart contract systems, I think they have to be decentralized. And that's what this technology does, so which I'm super excited about it. I haven't been as excited about this since like Ethereum or when I first heard about Bitcoin. So it's really cool and kind of interesting is that Bitcoin was 2009 and then 2014 was Ethereum. So 5 years later, then 5 years later is this. So there's a nice symmetry to the whole thing.
Nice. I like it. I appreciate you coming on. I got one more of just an opinion question for you here. We talked about ICOs, we talked about STOs, but the new big thing right now is IEOs, mm-hmm. internal exchange offerings. To me, they're really, really similar to the ICO hype phase where everybody's, as much as they can, they're grabbing it. And if you can get a little bit, you're for the retail investor, they're looking at good returns in a very short period of time, which makes it very attractive to a lot of people. We've seen Binance do it. We're seeing Bittrex attempted to do it. We've seen a bunch of exchanges pick it up. What are your thoughts on this? Is it fully legal? Like, what's kind of the thought pattern with what's going on? Like,
you can nitpick with this comment I'm going to make, but it's really just high level. It's really, I think it's the right aspect. It was that the IEOs are ICOs that are being issued on a, you know, sister platform to a utility token exchange. So Binance has Launchpad, and, you know, each one of these, KHOBE, they're all coming out or have announced ones similar. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. It's just you're still back in the same regulatory framework. So the fact that it's issued and there's an I instead of a C in the name, and then it's issued on an exchange-like platform or exchange-owned platform, doesn't change any of the regulatory aspects. What it does do, where I have a lot more hope, that because I still believe that utility tokens are going to be a massive market, that a lot of people think they're dead, and I don't think ICOs are dead or the utility token market. I think both of them are going to come back in a huge way. Utility tokens are this entire new asset that we've just never had before. Where these are more beneficial is that a couple things. One, the exchanges act as a little bit more of a rational mindset in terms of they're the gatekeepers. And so if the new ICO is done on an exchange type of system, you need to get through these people are like probably some of the smartest guys in this space, and it's less likely that scams or even things that are maybe securities, because they have their own legal departments reviewing things, are going to get through. But especially the scams or frankly, projects that just don't have a validity to them. You know, they're unlikely to, you may argue with, you know, is it or not, and there's going to be a lot still more than not are going to fail over time. But there's this, you know, relatively smart group of people there that are analyzing this. So that's a huge thing. So what you're seeing is that instead of seeing a $50 or $100 million offering, you're seeing like $5 million offerings. And instead of seeing, you know, a project that just has a white paper, you know, you're seeing things like, you know, the first one that I think was big was BitTorrent. And hey, agree or don't agree with the token, but nobody's can disagree with the validity of BitTorrent and how many users it has. And it's a super amazing open source project and been around for almost 20 years. And look at your established brand and like that. That's, you know, if that's the kind of thing that's coming, that's a lot. It's a world difference from what we were talking about before. The other things that they can do that was a lot more, a lot easier for them to do is if you want to have an offering, and let's say people don't, because of regulatory uncertainty, don't want to touch the U.S. right now, or by the way, other jurisdictions. We're not the only unclear jurisdiction out there right now. There's more unclear than clear. Or let's say China, which is pretty clear, no. Especially with ICOs. I don't know if they've taken a hard stance on IEOs. There's been rumblings, but it's, you know, it's hard to tell what's real or not. And I just came back from there and I didn't get a clear answer myself on that. But it does seem like the exchanges there are going for it. So the exchanges have the ability where you want to do an IEO there and you can say, look, I don't want, because of the jurisdiction I'm located in as the issuer, and my legal team is telling me I don't want to be in this country, that country, and this country, and so they can pretty easily, you know, block any of the accounts that come from those countries. You are relying on the AML KYC of the exchanges when people sign up for their accounts initially. And so you have to put trust in that. So you have to investigate whether or not this is an exchange that I trust that do that. And the top ones do a pretty decent job of that. You know, I'm sure they can always do a better job, but it's, you know, you have to be pretty good to get around some of their stuff, and I'm sure people do. But it's a lot better than saying, I'm going to set up a smart contract to some website that nobody's ever gone to. I have no security measures on these websites. These websites get attacked, like, incessantly during the sales. And you're in a much more controlled, secure environment. It's you don't have phishing websites where it's, you know, one letter off or something, and then people send a whole bunch of Ether or Bitcoin to this address, and it, you know, it's not even the real address. And so a lot of these problems that did plague it, they clean up a lot of that. And I have a lot of hope for the IEOs, because I think the IEOs have the potential to finally legitimize this market. And it will come at some point. I think that it's really early, so they need some time to figure it out themselves. But the ones that I've talked to, their heads are in the right place. They're interested in legitimacy. They're not interested in a quick hit. And they're doing their due diligence on the projects themselves. So there's a lot more confidence in the ones that the investors come to.
Cool. So you think this is actually something that has the potential to be around for a while? It isn't just like a hype phase?
No. I think these are... you know, the ICO just changes its stripes in terms of how it is. Yeah, I think this is the potential to eliminate a lot of the abuses we saw in the ICO arena, but keeping the benefit of people being able to buy, you know, a participatory right in a new network. That's kind of what they're doing. And so people still want to participate in these new networks, and there's going to be pick your number with however many zeros behind it, networks and tokens, and it's, you know, the whole economy, and you see billions or trillions or whatever the number is of different tokens, you know, over time, but that's its own, like, you know, economy, and that's its whole new asset class, and not asset in the sense of necessarily increasing in value, even though some of them do. But asset and access in terms of all these new networks that we want to participate in, how do we participate in them? Mm-hmm. Tokens is the answer. And I think, you know, down the road, a lot of people, you know, think that we may have tens of thousands or thousands of tokens in our wallet to access all kinds of services that we're looking to access.
Interesting. I like it, man. Thanks for coming and joining me today. I appreciate it a lot.
But it was a real pleasure. And this was enjoy your podcast, and hope to be back.
I appreciate the love. You got anything you want to plug yourself, Casper Labs, anything like that that you want to share with the audience?
Yeah, we're looking, you know, Casper Labs is where, you know, I'm very much focused right now, and we're want as much community support as possible. We're very much collaborative with all of the other protocols out there, and you know, we want to be a good member of the community. So anybody's interested should go to casperlabs.io, check it out, you know, ping us, and we'd love to have them participate.
Perfect, brother. Thank you so much.
Thank you a lot.
Thank you, everybody, for tuning in to Evolvement, the financial podcast where we talk about Bitcoin, cryptocurrency, and the future of our financial system. Steven's been an awesome guest. I really appreciate having him on, and we will catch you guys at the next episode. Peace.
This has been the Evolvement Podcast with your boy, Nye. Thanks for tuning in. Head over to evolvement.io for updates and join us next week for an all-new episode. Peace.